Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement by Deputy National Security Advisor Ben Rhodes Friday that the US will not be restricted by borders in going after the Islamic State, and speak with an expert on Syria, Ori Baki, who served on the State Department's policy planning staff and has an article at Foreign Affairs on again, off again alliance. We will discuss the de facto alliance with Syria's Assad shaping up if the US starts bombing ISIL in Syria, and the different approach the French take in paying ransom for the release of their hostages held by terrorists. Then we'll go to Turkey and speak with Mohammed Ayoub, the University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University and author of the new book, Will the Middle East Implode? We will discuss the extent to which Turkey has buyer's remorse after having helped create ISIL in Syria, particularly now that the Islamic State fighters are threatening to exterminate Iraqi Turkmen in the besieged city of Emily that has seriously alarmed the United Nations Special Representative for Iraq, who has asked the international community to take immediate action to avoid a massacre of civilians who have been under siege for 2 months without food and water. Then finally, we will look into the resolve of the Ukrainians to fight the war that their new president, Petro Poroshenko, declared on Independence Day, August the 24th, has turned into a real war, albeit an undeclared one. Taras Kuzio, a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta, joins us to discuss the upcoming talks in Belarus between Poroshenko and Putin, who is increasing military pressure on Iran, on Ukraine, just short of an all-out invasion. And joining us now is Ori Baki, who's a professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence from 1998 to 2000. And he's authored, co-authored, and edited 5 books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. He has an article at Foreign Affairs on again, off again alliance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ori Baki.
Thank you.
And the Syrian government has just acknowledged that the Tabqa air base, which was the last remaining stronghold of Assad's government in Raqqa province, has fallen to the Islamic ISIL fighters. They've said that they tactically withdrew and that they will take it back, but it looks like a defeat. I thought Assad was making gains, but this seems like a reversal.
Well, Assad has been making gains against the regular moderate opposition, but not against ISIS. I mean, with ISIS, first of all, Assad had not been really fighting. They allowed ISIS to grow because it was very convenient for the Syrians to be able to show the rest of the world that the choice was between the Assad regime, or real crazy jihadists. So they have not been attacking ISIS, even though ISIS has occasionally attacked them. And this reversal for the Syrian government is actually quite serious, because psychologically it's important. It's an important air base. It's also the fact that ISIS has gone after them in a major way for the first time. But so the gains that the regime has been making has not been at the expense of ISIS. It's been at the expense of the Free Syrian Army and all the other so-called moderate opposition forces, which are much further west in the country than what ISIS is.
So if the U.S. proceeds on what both General Dempsey recently said, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that you can't really get rid of the Islamic State fighters in Iraq unless you take them on in Syria, and now Ben Rhodes on Friday saying that the U.S. is not going to be restricted by borders, what do you expect to happen, Ori? Are they what's left of the secular opposition to build on?
Well, let's be very clear. I think what Dempsey and Ben Rhodes are hinting at is that when they do military operations, i.e., air operations with drones or manned aircraft, that they will not restrict themselves to bombing ISIS targets that are only in Iraq. Because many of the equipment, many of the fighters often come from Syria. The border between Syria and Iraq has ceased to exist many, many years ago. I would say two and a half years ago, that border had ceased to exist. We only now are recognizing that that border is no longer operational. So it doesn't really matter in that part of the region whether or not you are 10 kilometers or 10 miles inside Syrian territory or 10 miles inside Iraqi territory. That is completely insignificant, right? So what Ben Rhodes and Dempsey are trying to suggest is, look, if we see ISIS troops coming in from Syria into Iraq, we'll bomb them, and we'll bomb them wherever they are. We're not going to try to figure out exactly where the border is and say, oh, we're going to have to wait until they cross the border before we can hit them. Right, this is now a regional conflict that includes at least two countries, and the United States is going to act accordingly. But we should not exaggerate these statements by these gentlemen to think that we're starting a new, brand new campaign against ISIS again in Syria, and now we're going to try to push ISIS, try to defeat ISIS in Syria. No, it's actually the American operations so far have been ones to buy time for the Kurds and for the Iraqi army to get their act together and start pushing back. It is not an operation that is designed to defeat ISIS by itself. It cannot. Unless you put troops on the ground, we cannot do it. All we're doing is buying time and becoming essentially the air force of the Kurds and, lesser extent, the Iraqis.
But what Ben Rhodes did say, though, was that the killing of the U.S. photojournalist James Foley by the Islamic State, ISIL, constituted a terrorist attack against the United States. They represent a terrorist attack against our country and against an American citizen. So there are some reports that the Assad regime or criminals may have initially captured Foley and handed him over to the Syrian Assad's Air Force intelligence people. And in turn, they handed him over, or somebody handed him over to ISIS. I guess this murky relationship between the Assads and ISIS have been going on for some time, have they not? Now it seems to have changed, but it would seem to me not beyond the realm of possibility that the Assads would have done this, because they aren't they wanting the Americans to come in on their side against ISIS?
Look, I don't think that the Assad regime ever thought that the United States is going to come in on their side to fight anybody, especially when the United States has been supporting the opposition. I think what they want is for politically the United States to change sides in the following sense, to accept essentially that Assad is the lesser of the two evils. That's what we are. But when it comes to Foley, let me just say two things here. One is, this is a civil war going on in Syria, where we don't really know exactly who's fighting when and on whose side. And it is quite possible that you have renegade elements within the regime, within the Air Force, who had Foley and then decided to make a side deal with ISIS and sell Foley. And ISIS has money. I mean, so people take advantage of such conflict situations to do really unspeakable, unimaginable things sometimes with human life. So I wouldn't put it past a group of Air Force thugs, maybe if they were the ones who were holding Foley, to make a side deal and then tell the Syrian regime, oh, he escaped from us. One. Two, on the Ben Rhodes statement saying that this is an act of war or terrorism against the United States, well, that's true. I mean, the fact is that when Ben Rhodes and the White House say these things, they're desperately trying to justify their limited operations in Iraq and maybe now in Syria, because they think that the American public is not ready to support any kind of military action. So if you notice that even when the first sorties of aircraft were done to support the Kurds in against ISIS, the White House kept insisting that this was done to protect American lives who happened to be in the Kurdish areas, either at our consulate or other parts of Kurdistan. They always emphasized that they were protecting American lives because the White House is petrified that the president who promised to get out of Iraq and who got out of Iraq is being dragged back into Iraq, and that will damage his reputation and his legacy. So every you shouldn't pass these statements so thoroughly in the sense that there's a great deal of, shall we say, domestic propaganda involved here in order to justify the White House. I mean, the White House is perfectly justified in doing what it is doing now. It is in national interest of the United States to stop ISIS from moving further in Iraq against our allies, especially the Kurds. But the White House, the White House is tying itself in circles, just trying to justify this. So I wouldn't really spend too much time looking at what Ben Rhodes says or anybody else says in these propaganda speeches.
But in terms of the captives held with James Foley, two of the French journalists captured were ransomed out, and the French government quietly paid we don't know how much money. We know that the ISIL people asked for 100 million euros from Global Post, the company for which James Foley was working. And by the way, the Global Post people thought that they were all along were dealing with the elements of Assad's Air Force intelligence in their negotiations. So what is the fundamental difference there between the way the French government handles this and the United States government handles hostages?
But look, it's not just the French government. The Europeans in general have always made deals for hostages, always. They've made deals in the past with when the Palestinians hijacked or kidnapped their citizens. They made deals with Hezbollah in Lebanon. They have always made deals. So we, in that sense, European and American policy has been at odds with each other or different from each other for decades. So this is not something new. The United States takes quite an adamant position of not negotiating. Even there, it does sometimes negotiate in order to be able to see what it can do, and we have negotiated at times. I mean, if you think about the Iran hostage crisis was, I'm talking about the hostages in Lebanon. Those, we did deal with the Iranians. But what the United States tries to avoid is to do deals with terrorist organizations or really awesome organizations or terrible organizations like ISIS, because that is going to create a serious, serious precedent. And that's one. Number two, the U.S. is a superpower. So in that sense, it sees itself, it perceives itself differently than the way the French and the English or the British or the Germans do in Europe. So It thinks it has to uphold a principle and live up to its principle much more so than others. And so, I mean, those are the two basic reasons why the United States acts differently. Whether or not it should negotiate is another question. I mean, that's a debate maybe America should have, but then the moment you do that, every American becomes a target for anybody around the world. So that's also problematic.
And, of course, the other hostage murderers of Foley paraded in front of the cameras, he's next in line, and presumably because the U.S. has not obviously backed down from their bombing of the Islamic State fighters in Iraq, his fate is extremely grim.
And remember that the United States did try to mount a rescue operation that unfortunately did not produce the desired results. So when the United States did mount a very large operation to put, to save this other hostage in Foley, it shows you that the U.S. is taking this very seriously and is trying to do something about it. What it won't do is obviously get into a game of negotiations.
Well, just in the last few minutes, Henri Bakke, let's turn to your article in Foreign Affairs, On Again, Off Again Alliance, which is about the history of the U.S. Dealing with the Kurds. And the Kurds, of course, have every reason to be skeptical, or at least in terms of trusting the United States, since they were sold out by, I guess, by Henry Kissinger during the Nixon administration when the Shah reversed himself and made a deal with Saddam, selling them out. A lot of has been made about the Peshmergas fighting prowess, and now lately people have been questioning that. The Peshmerga are saying, no, it's not that we can't fight. You know, we've got veterans from the from the Iran-Iraq war in the ranks, middle-aged men, but they're holding old rusty Kalashnikovs, and the U.S. won't give the, give us arms, and they insist on funneling through the Iraqi state, which is dysfunctional and has been denying both payments for oil, I understand, as, along with weapons. So where does that stand in terms of arming the Kurds?
Well, first of all, you see that the Europeans, the Germans, the British, the Italians, the French, are all now saying that they will arm the Kurds. So that already is a good step. And I think the United States will also do it. What will happen, however, is that what the U.S. is waiting for is for a new government to be set up in Baghdad. Nouri al-Maliki, the current prime minister, is stepping down. There's some hope that the new government will put things together in the sense of, I mean, improve relations between Baghdad and the Kurdish region. And then through that, you have, if you have a less antagonistic prime minister, the two regions will start working together. And then you can do all kinds of rearming in that, through that process. I think we have to be a little bit patient and see what happens. I mean, the government, they have another 10 or 15 days before they form a government. And I suspect some kind of government will be formed. But generally, it is true that we, until probably recently, always looked at the Kurds as rather insignificant or not that important to us. There's a very famous quote I use from in that article from Brent Scowcroft, who was Henry Kissinger's primary aide during those days, and then later became George Bush Sr.'s national security advisor, when he was asked by a journalist about the betrayal of the Kurds, he said they were small potatoes. Well, they're not small potatoes anymore. Now they're actually a linchpin for the United States and for the region. I mean, they're far too important because the events of the last 20 years have brought them to the fore. It's not just Kurds in Iraq. It's Kurds in Syria now that are fighting. It's Kurds in Iraq that are very, very active, in Turkey that are very active. And someday the Kurds of Iran are also going to be able to play a bigger role. So the Kurds are now both an element of stability, but also a potential element of instability. And this is not the Middle East of 20 years ago, where you had very powerful centralized states in Syria, in Iraq, elsewhere. The region has changed a great deal. So the Kurds now have a much wider window of opportunity and ability to play, and we will have to take them much more seriously, and we do. I mean, and in fact, look, the current operations against ISIS are done, again, the White House says we're supporting the Iraqi security forces, but in reality, we are supporting Kurdish Peshmerga forces. And Kurdish Peshmerga forces did not do very well against ISIS, but that was quite understandable. The positions that were overrun by ISIS were positions that they had taken over when the Iraqi army collapsed. They were filling out a vacuum. They didn't send the best troops. They sent whatever they could find. It was just a holding operation. It is true that the Iraqi Kurds are not as powerful as they used to be militarily, but remember, a great deal of the defeat of that ISIS suffered at the hands of the Kurds were at the hands of the Syrian and, to a lesser extent, the Turkish Kurds, who are now fighting ISIS in Syria. President Obama at one point said, well, we broke the siege of Mount Sinjar to save the Yazidi community there. The truth fact is that the siege was broken by the Syrian Kurds, who punched a hole in the ISIS lines and evacuated 20,000 refugees there, with, of course, the indirect support of the American Air Force. But nonetheless, the Iraqi and Syrian Kurds are a new factor in the region that will not be able to ignore and call small potatoes again.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Ori Baki. Again, I've been speaking with Ori Baki, professor of international relations at Lehigh University. He served as a member of the United States State Department policy planning staff, working primarily on the Middle East, the Eastern Mediterranean, and intelligence, and has authored, co-authored, and edited five books, among them Turkey's Kurdish Question with Graham Fuller, Reluctant Neighbor, Turkey's Role in the Middle East, and most recently, European Responses to Globalization, Resistance, Adaptation, and Alternatives. He has an article at Foreign Affairs, On Again, Off Again Alliance. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether Turkey has buyer's remorse after having helped create ISIS. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Turkey is Muhammad Ayub, who is the University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, where he holds a joint appointment in James Madison College and the Department of Political Science. A specialist on conflict and security in the Third World, he's also researched, taught, and published on the intersection of religion and politics in the Muslim world, and has been a consultant to the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, the High-Level Panel on Threats, Challenges, and Change, appointed by the UN Secretary General. His books include The Many Faces of Political Islam, Religion and Politics in the Muslim World, and his latest is Will the Middle East Implode? Welcome to Background Briefing, Muhammad Ayub.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
And your book is very prescient, Muhammad. And of course, you know, one doesn't want to accept the premise that the Middle East is imploding because of what it implies. But it's certainly looking that way, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's quite disturbing because 3 years ago when the Arab Spring began, many of us were very optimistic about the direction that the Middle East was going to take. But unfortunately, the Arab Spring has turned into an Arab winter. The democratic movements or attempted changes have been aborted, and we are in a worse situation today than we were before the Arab Spring began.
And in terms of Turkey, where you are, there's a new prime minister who is the former foreign minister, I'm wondering about whether Turkey is undergoing buyer's remorse for its early support of ISIL or ISIS or IS, as they, Islamic State, as they now want to call themselves. I mean, given what's happening now in the Iraqi town or city of Amalie, which has been under siege for 2 months without food and water, the United Nations Special Representative for Iraq has asked the international community to take immediate action to avoid a massacre of civilians there. And of course, these civilians are Iraqi Turkmen who have a strong cultural, linguistic, and historical tie to Turkey. So that seems to me to be a glaring irony.
Well, in a way it is, but on the other hand, it probably is not, because Initially, the Turkish support was meant for the democratic movement that was opposing President Bashar al-Assad. The Islamist component of it was present. It was supposed to be a minor one. And certainly the extremist jihadis were not all that prominent early on. And I guess some of the support that went through Turkey to the opposition did probably reach the likes of the ISIS. But I don't think there was a deliberate policy on the part of Turkey to support those elements. Turkey was much more interested in the democratic opposition succeeding in overthrowing the narrowly based Assad regime. Unfortunately, that didn't happen, and Turkey found itself caught in this Syria, what I call the Syrian quagmire, and has been finding it very difficult to extricate itself. There is, I don't know whether there's remorse, but there's certainly been a lot of rethinking and reevaluation of the policy. I think the policy initially was based on the right assumptions, because, you know, the Turkish government's own democratic legitimacy is based on, you know, being sympathetic to and supporting democratic movements. And I think that was one of the main drivers for Turkish foreign policy towards Syria. The prime minister in waiting, Ahmed Davutoğlu, was in many ways the main craftsman for the Turkish foreign policy and reorienting it towards the Muslim Middle East, while at the same time keeping its ties with NATO and the West intact. It was obviously a very difficult balancing act, but for a while he and the Turkish government were able to do it very well. And I'm not so sure that things have gone, you know, that things would go so far against Turkish interests. I have a feeling they might still be able to salvage it.
But what evidence is there, or what do you think Turkey's going to do? I mean, they do have a fairly robust economic ties with the Kurdish or the nascent Kurdish mm-hmm. Republic in the north of Iraq. But there's obviously a great deal of international concern following ISIS's threat on Erbil, and that has led to the Kurds asking for weapons directly as opposed to getting them from Iraq. And there's the Incirlik Air Base there, which I believe a NATO base, but I don't believe it's being used at the moment. And, of course, Turkey has in the back of its mind, if you will, the fact that there are 22 million Kurds living in Turkey itself. So presumably a Kurdish independence in the north of Iraq will have its problems for Turkey. But to what extent are they alarmed by what's happening in Iraq?
Well, I think the Turks are extremely alarmed at what is happening in Iraq, particularly the unbridgeable rift between the Sunnis and the Shias. Obviously, the reasons for this rift are not theological but political. But to get back to Turkey and Turkey's relations with the Kurds, the government under Prime Minister Erdogan and Davutoğlu's government is obviously going to follow the same policy, has adopted over the years a rather wise policy towards both the Iraqi Kurdish regional autonomous government and towards its own Kurdish population, which means that today the Kurdish problem within Turkey is far nearer solution than it has ever been, I think, in the last 4 or 5 decades. And the Turks under Erdogan did a real turnaround in terms of their policy towards Iraqi Kurdistan. They realized that that Iraqi Kurdistan was heavily dependent economically upon Turkey, and that because it's landlocked and Turkey provided the economic lifeline for it. And they also realized that they could use the leaders of the Kurdistan government to put pressure on the extremist Kurdish elements within Turkey to enter into a compromise solution with Ankara. And that is why today the Kurdish autonomous entity in northern Iraq and Ankara are the best of friends. And Ankara actually has heavily invested economically in the prosperity of Iraqi Kurdistan. I think the Turkish government has, in fact, probably come to accept the fact that short of a formal declaration of independence, the Kurdish entity in northern Iraq will act, and it has already been acting as such in the last few years as an independent state, and they are willing to live with it. I think if Iraq disintegrates, and this is a big if, and if Kurdistan, and if northern Iraq or the Kurdish part of Iraq becomes an independent state, the Turkish government will reconcile itself to that fact and work closely with them to build a haven of peace and prosperity in this part of the Middle East.
And given that the Deputy National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes, said on Friday that U.S. will not be restricted by borders in going after the Islamic State, meaning that they will go after them in Syria as well as in northern Iraq, what is the likelihood of the Incirlik Air Base being used?
It could be used, but I think the Americans, the United States, is very hesitant in escalating its attacks on the ISIS basis. And this, there is another irony to this whole ISIS phenomenon and preceding it, the Al Qaeda in Iraq phenomenon, because in a way, both of them were the creation of the United States. The American invasion of Iraq in 2003 that led to the unraveling of the Iraqi state, thanks to the misguided policy of the then American proconsul Bremer, who totally devastated the state machinery in Iraq, and Iraq reached was virtually a failed state, which allowed the extremist elements who had been cornered in Afghanistan, and of course many of them are also native Iraqi and Syrian born. To use first Iraq, and then when Syria began to unravel, to use Syria as their base of operations. So in a way, this is a Frankenstein's monster that Washington had created for itself. There is, I must point out, a major difference between the ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Well, two major differences. One, the ISIS is far too brutal even for Al-Qaeda's liking, the way they have been behaving in the past few months. Secondly, unlike Al-Qaeda, which was the Al-Qaeda Central, if you want to call it that, which was interested primarily in confronting and attacking the far enemy, which meant the United States, the ISIS's goal is primarily local and regional in character. The ISIS doesn't recognize boundaries within the Fertile Crescent, the boundaries between Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon, which were imposed by the British and the French, the colonial masters of the recent past. But they want to create a regional state, which they would call the Islamic Caliphate or the Islamic State, as they call it today. And so their primary target or targets are the near enemies, the Syrian government, the Iraqi government, the Shias of Iraq, and elements in Lebanon who are opposed to their regional objectives. They are not primarily concerned with attacking the United States.
So in your new book, Mohammed Ayoub, Will the Middle East Implode?, you talk about that the military coup that ousted Morsi from power was a catastrophe for Egyptian democracy and the Arab Spring's most dramatic and possibly irreversible setback. But you can't extricate the Saudis from that, surely. I mean, the Saudis have financed this new government, given it a blank check, and as soon as the military coup happened, suddenly foodstuffs and oil and gas were available. The hand of Saudi Arabia is throughout this whole radicalization of Islam throughout the world. And there was actually a very strong piece in the New York Times on Saturday about, talk about our original question, which is buyer's remorse. I don't know how much buyer's remorse there is in Saudi Arabia about helping create these radical movements like Al-Qaeda and now the Islamic State. But
yeah, no, sorry.
Go ahead. Well, I was going to ask you in the broader sense. I mean, why do we cling to the Saudis, who clearly have used religion in order to maintain the family power over that country and its vast oil wealth, and they are so deeply opposed to any form of democracy? Why don't we nurture and work with the democracies in Turkey and even to some extent in Iran? But yet we are so wedded to Saudi Arabia, who have been so duplicitous and backstabbing for so long. It's just breathtaking.
Yeah, you have two questions, actually, or there are two parts of this question. On the first one, the Egyptian issue, the Saudis have been the main one of the main culprits as far as the overthrow of Egyptian democracy is concerned. And there's an irony to that as well, because the Morsi government was a Muslim Brotherhood government, who are also considered to be Islamists, just as Saudi Arabia is considered to be an Islamist or Islamic government. But if there is one thing that the Saudi ruling house is mortally afraid of, even more than the Shia of Iran and the surrounding areas, is a movement like the Muslim Brotherhood, which, unlike Saudi Islamism, which is, or Wahhabism, which preaches or teaches the population, the subjects in the Arabian Peninsula to be docile and accept whatever orders are given to them by the ruling house, the Muslim Brotherhood has been committed to popular political mobilization. And this is an Islamism from below that the Saudis mortally fear that if this catches on in the Arabian Peninsula, they would be, the Saudi regime would be seriously undermined. As far as the second part of your question about the American support for Saudi Arabia is concerned, I mean, in one word, of course, it is energy. I mean, even though the United States itself may not be heavily dependent on Saudi oil or even on Gulf oil, most of the American allies, the industrialized countries in Europe and Japan, are. So that's one of the main things. The other thing that drives American policy, and this has been, as you hinted yourself, something that needed to be reevaluated a long time ago, is the animus towards Iran. And Saudi Arabia is perceived as the local counterweight to Iran. And the Saudis have therefore taken advantage of both of these dependencies, if you want to call it that, of the United States, to do whatever they want to do in the Gulf and beyond, in the Fertile Crescent, while expecting the Americans to continue to support them. Now, it is true that in the long run, American and Saudi interests do not converge. In fact, as you hinted yourself, there might even be an emerging convergence of interests between Iran and the United States. Much more so than between the United States and Saudi Arabia, and particularly in relation to the extremists, the Sunni extremist jihadist elements like the ISIS, who are ideologically very close to Saudi Arabia, though in a way the Saudis are afraid of them also, because they're far too radical for the taste of the Saudi monarchs. That the United States, but the main point is that the United States and Iran should, while discussing the negotiating on the Iranian nuclear issue, take these wider issues of convergence of interest into account as well. And that the United States should really reevaluate its approach towards Iran. I consider Iran and Turkey to be the two pivotal powers in the Middle East. And American relations with Iran and Turkey should be put on an even keel as far as Iran is concerned, and should remain on an even keel as far as Turkey is concerned. Because without the cooperation of Turkey and Iran, and both of them have long-standing state traditions, unlike most of the Arab states of the Fertile Crescent, they cannot, without an understanding between Turkey and Iran and an understanding between Turkey, Iran, and the United States, there cannot be a legitimate security regime that can be established in the Middle East.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, let's talk about the ultimate conundrum here, which is Syria, where in your new book, Mohammed Ayoub, Will the Middle East Implode? On the one hand, you point out that the Assad regime, this family dictatorship, has to go, but not at the price of all the state institutions that are being destroyed as we speak. And on the other hand, you say that had Obama launched the military strike on the regime, as it had threatened over the chemical weapons, it may have brought down the Assads, but it also may have created other catastrophes. Well, we've certainly reached that point, and now you have the irony where we're not entirely sure whether the Assads or elements of the Assad regime actually handed the American reporter over to ISIS, but there's some real possibility that that's the case. But short of that, it's pretty clear that Assad must be very happy with what Ben Rhodes said, that we may go after the IS in Syria.
Yeah, so there is a convergence of interest there also between the Assad regime and the American administration. The problem with many of these states like Iraq, the states that were artificially created at the end of the First World War by what's known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement between Britain and France, is their artificial character. And so they are basically fragile states. Lebanon was the prime example until recently, but Syria and Iraq are now very much there. In fact, they've gone ahead of Lebanon in terms of being in the league of fragile states. And in these states, what has held these states together are basically regimes based on the notion of a strong man with a coterie around him. When the strong man and the coterie begin to fail or their power begins to erode, it means not merely the overthrow of the regime, but also the unraveling of the state. And that's what's been happening in Iraq. That's what's been happening in Syria. So this is a conundrum that the United States and other powers face, is how to save the state while still getting rid of the dictatorship. They were unable to do so in Iraq. When Saddam Hussein went, he took the entire state apparatus with him, in a sense. And, of course, the American policy has contributed to it. But the state and the regime were so closely aligned with each other, in a way, that if one went, the other was, in a way, bound to go. So this is a conundrum. It's a basic conundrum that the major powers face. And, of course, one can argue that the only way out of this is to establish democratic frameworks that work autonomously of external interference, but that's easier, more easily said than done. But I would argue that external interference makes the internal issues in these countries far more worse. And one of the external, one of the manifestations of that phenomenon is the regional Cold War between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And there's actually in Syria and Iraq and in Lebanon. There are proxy wars being fought where groups, internal domestic groups allied with Saudi Arabia and other domestic groups allied with Iran are fighting each other. Now, the whole Fertile Crescent is, as a result, in a big mess. And to add to that, you have the Americans and the Russians and the Europeans playing their own game makes things far worse.
Well, Mohammed Ayoub, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Oh, you're most welcome. Yeah.
Again, I've been speaking with Mohammed Ayoub, who is in Turkey. He's the University Distinguished Professor of International Relations at Michigan State University, and he has been a consultant to the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty, the high-level panel on threats, challenges, and change appointed by the UN Secretary General. And his books include The Many Faces of Political Islam, Religion, and Politics in the Muslim World, and his latest is Will the Middle East Implode? We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about Putin's increasing military pressure on Ukraine, which is just short of an all-out invasion. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Taras Kuzio, who's a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta, and a fellow with the Center of for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to Background Briefing, Taras Kuzio. So, hi, Taras, and the Sunday, of course, is the Ukrainian National Independence Day, and there were military parades in Kiev, and the new president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, declared on television that the war has turned into a real war, albeit an undeclared one. So what's your sense of the resolve of the Ukrainian people to fight this war? There could be a long one against Russia, given the dire economic straits the country's in.
Well, the he's right to say it is a de facto undeclared war, or proxy war, however you want to describe it, because Russia is training and sending mercenaries. It's sending high-level, high-tech equipment, such as surface-to-air missiles, tanks, APCs. It's also firing artillery and rockets from Russia into Ukraine, and it's daily infringing Ukraine airspace with aircraft and drones. So if it's a duck and walks and quacks like a duck, it's a duck. This is a war. Some Western commentators, such as former U.S. Secretary of State Strobe Talbot, former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine John Herbst, both prominent today in Washington, D.C., say this is a war. The U.S. and the EU don't really want to call it a war as such, because that would require them to implement far tougher Iranian-style sector sanctions against Russia. And it's been very difficult to get them to even adopt the sanctions they've got so far vis-a-vis Russia. I mean, it took down the tragic shooting down of the Malaysian airliner for them to move. It wasn't enough for Russia to occupy the Crimea for them to impose tough sanctions. It had to be the Malaysian airliner. So we're in this kind of phony war situation. It is a de facto Russian undeclared war against Ukraine, and coupled with the annexation of one part of its territory. Russia saying that we're not involved in Ukraine at all. I mean, it's completely George Orwellian, the kind of statements coming out of Moscow. Just yesterday, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs said that the so-called humanitarian convoy legally entered Ukraine and that there are no Russian forces in eastern Ukraine. They're obviously living on a completely different planet to us. And the West doesn't really want to declare that this is a full-scale war, because then it would have to adopt tougher sanctions. So we're in this kind of phony area at the moment, a kind of phony undeclared war.
Well, on Saturday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel in Kiev for talks with Petro Poroshenko urged both sides to strive for a new ceasefire, and she also cautioned Russia that worse EU sanctions could be underway. And, of course, on Tuesday, Poroshenko is meeting with Putin in Belarus. So what's going on here? On the one hand, Putin seems to be doing everything he can to support his surrogates, his proxies in the east, to make sure they don't get defeated by the Ukrainian army at the expense of major cities being devastated. At the same time, he's going to talk. So this is what the good cop, bad cop regime, is that what it is?
Well, it is, yes. I mean, nothing will come out of the meeting in Minsk. At the same time, one has to remember that there is unease amongst many of Russia's allies in the CIS, such as Belarus and Kazakhstan, both of whom have very large numbers of Russian speakers, at Putin's policies. And they're not very interested in imposing boycott on Ukrainian goods. And actually, Lukashenko, being the wily leader of Belarus, is permitting EU goods to enter Russia through Belarus and making money out of it. So I don't expect any diplomatic breakthrough. There can't be diplomatic breakthrough whilst, to be quite honest, Putin's in power. Of course, Western leaders such as Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, will have to try to undertake some kind of diplomatic negotiations, because that's what diplomats and world leaders do. But I'm not optimistic that this will lead to a breakthrough, because President Putin is very emotional about Ukraine. He's riding on a wave of nationalism in Russia. He can't be seen to be betraying those nationalist constituencies inside Russia. and he's invested a lot in what he's doing in Ukraine. This is sending a signal to other countries in that region that do not try to integrate with the West, because this is what's going to happen to you. So I don't see Putin backing down. If the insurgency, the separatist campaign in Donetsk is defeated, as it probably will be in the next month or so, with heavy loss of life and damage, this will transform into a terrorist campaign, which, as we know even from Northern Ireland, in the case of the Ulster Troubles, it could last decades, especially when a foreign country such as Russia is going to continue to support it. So I don't think Russia's very worried, very concerned at the threat from Angela Merkel about further sanctions. He's bitten the bullet until now for the sanctions. He's kind of laughed them off, and his attitude towards human life and towards human misery is the more the better. He hopes there's destruction in Donetsk, because that will increase discontent with Kiev. He doesn't give a damn about human life, as we saw with the Malaysian airliner.
Well, he does care about his own tenure. I don't think he expects to leave the Kremlin unless in a coffin. And
of course.
And he, his compact with the Russian people is basically, I'll raise your standard of living, but you just forget about politics. And that's what's happened. But the standard of living is likely to go down because of these sanctions, even on the food. And I'm just wondering how long you can maintain that extraordinary propaganda bubble that's been so effective in Russia, that basically it says that black is white and white is black. And it's also Russian propaganda is also pervasive in Belarus. Even if Lukashenko has qualms about Putin, his own people are completely in the dark as to what is happening in Ukraine, as they are in Armenia and throughout the entire former Soviet Union. It's pretty amazing how effective the propaganda machine has been.
Well, it is. It is amazing, especially inside Russia. I mean, Ukrainians use a phrase of zombification that they seem to see amongst the Russian population when you have something in the region of 80+% in support of Putin. And with it, for example, the majority of Russians believing that the Malaysian airline was shot down by Ukrainians, not by Russians. At the same time, yes, you're right to say that the middle classes, who are the ones who purchased Western commodities, foods and commodities, cars and such like luxury goods, and the ones who traveled abroad, are going to be the ones who are going to be hurt the most from the sanctions. It's not going to be the average Russian member of the proletariat or the peasantry who never buys a Mercedes-Benz or never travels to Europe. Yes, there will be discontent amongst the chattering classes, as it were, but will that be a threat to Putin? I somehow doubt it, because we know from many countries that nationalism just simply blinds people to reality. And Putin's established, some would call it a neo-fascist regime, a totalitarian regime. He's established a complete control over the country through his former intelligence agencies who control the economy, through the media. So it's difficult to see how they could be, say, a Ukrainian-style Euromaidan or Orange Revolution in the country. And there is Putin particularly inculcates and mobilizes that sort of very deep sense of Russian hatred towards the U.S. in particular, and this kind of feeling of stigmatization that the Russia has allegedly gone through since the collapse of the USSR. So Putin draws on a lot of this, and yes, I think the country will have to weather. It won't be back to the good old days of very high oil and gas prices that we saw earlier in the decade, but I'd be surprised if it's a real bona fide threat. But you're right to point out that he will never leave power. I mean, because his culture doesn't understand the concept of losing elections, but B, because he's afraid of losing power. If he leaves power, he knows he has no guarantees for his life and security.
Well, just in closing, Taras Kuzio, this convoy of Russian trucks came in, and nobody's quite sure what they delivered, although the assumption is it was humanitarian aid. But what apparently they took back with them were a lot of arms from the military factories that are in this area that's being contested by Putin's proxies and the Ukrainian army. And so what does that mean? If he takes the dies and tools from the armaments industry, is he hedging his bets that he may lose it? At the same time, he's got a fairly substantial army deployed on the border.
Well, the Ukraine, when it was part of the Soviet Union, contributed a huge proportion of the Soviet military-industrial complex, something in the region of 30% to 40% of Ukraine's economy at the time in the Soviet Union was devoted to the military-industrial complex. Ukraine had the largest military-industrial plant in the world that produced nuclear weapons. At the time, it had something in the region of 50,000 employees. So Russia has always felt that it needs components, cooperation, interaction with Ukraine's military-industrial complex. Of course, the current situation we have today and the current leadership of Ukraine is not very interested in that cooperation going further, and exports of military components and items to Russia has been stopped on the orders of President Poroshenko. So they may have stolen some parts of military-industrial plants which were in areas controlled by the terrorists. But this area controlled by the terrorists is a very small part of Luhansk region, so they wouldn't have taken back that much. It kind of resembles like the Soviet army in Germany during World War II, just basically dismantling everything it found and taking it back to the Soviet Union. So it's that kind of concept. But as for the Russian army on the borders, yes, it's a large force. It's intimidating. It's threatening. But if I don't think Putin's under any illusions. If he was to invade, this would be, A, force the West to impose Iranian-style sector sanctions. It could no longer then pretend that Russia wasn't invading. But secondly, the Russian forces would be actually opposed by a very powerful opposition from both Ukrainian forces and partisan forces. He shouldn't ever underestimate that. After all, Putin's big failure was that he expected all of the eight regions of southern and eastern Ukraine, which are Russian-speaking, to all rise up and support him, and they didn't. He only received support in two of the eight Russian-speaking regions. And so from that point of view, he's not likely to get massive support if he invades. On the contrary, it's going to lead to massive mobilization against him.
I don't think that
would undermine him.
Well, Taras Kuzia, I thank you very much for joining him.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Taras Kuzia, who is a leading international expert on contemporary Ukrainian and post-communist politics, nationalism, and European integration at the Center for Political and Regional Studies in the Canadian Institute for Ukrainian Studies at the University of Alberta. He's also a fellow with the Center for Transatlantic Relations at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcast at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.